You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, presented by Trainer Road, cycling's most effective training tool.
Hi, my name's David Gilbert, friend of the podcast and, of course, recent Trainer Road convert. Where am I today, Lionel? Well, for the past week or so, I've been laid up in hospital in the Alps, having been knocked over by a French autobus. So, as well as being a friend of the podcast, it's probably only a minor exaggeration to say that your recent episodes helped bring me back to life. So, thank you, Richard. Thank you, Lionel. Thank you, Daniel. Keep up the good work.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with the very smug-looking Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And a very glum-looking Daniel Freeb.
Hello, Richard. Lionel.
All right, chaps. How
Hello,
are you?
Lionel,
how are you
Richie
both
today?
No.
Not getting any
down
humor,
in the dumps.
Any mirth from me today. Sail on, Lionel. That's all I can say. That's a polite way, in the words of friend of the podcast, Lionel Richie, of telling you to get lost, basically.
That's fine. We should just explain what we're talking about. We've not had some big falling out. It was the FA Cup quarter-final at the weekend between my team and Daniel's team.
This is football.
Yeah, football. I can hear people switching off out there in podcast land.
This is going to be the only bit of football chat.
Yeah.
Lionel's team won, Daniel's team lost. Let's move on, shall we?
Yeah, let's.
Lionel, we've got lots to talk about. I'm going to say that a lot, but we've got Paris-Nice, we've got Tirreno Adriatico is ongoing. We're going to look ahead to Milan-San Remo, the first monument of the season. We're going to hear from Alexander Kristoff. We're going to hear a bit from David Miller. We're going to talk about extreme weather. Lots of forthright opinions on that. But first of all, Lionel, can you give us the weekly roundup, please?
I certainly can, yes. The big news of the week in terms of bike racing was Geraint Thomas won Paris-Nice, making it Sky's fourth win in 5 years and the third victory by a British rider after Tom Simpson in the 60s and Bradley Wiggins a few years ago now. Who knows, it might even take the sting out of Wales losing the rugby and Arsenal getting knocked out of the FA Cup for Geraint. You never know, that's the only other.
Enough, Lionel.
Sorry. There was controversy on a couple of days at Paris-Nice. Nasser Bouhanni was stripped of a stage win for an illegal sprint against Michael Matthews on stage two, although the Cofidis rider did make amends by winning fairly a couple of days later. And arguably the toughest stage finish of the race to Montbrui was stopped and cancelled because of snow, and that did change the complexion of the race for the overall contenders, and we'll discuss that a bit later in the episode. Geraint Thomas took the lead with a fine ride on Lamadon Dutel. The stage was won by Katusha's Ilnur Zakarin. Thomas and Team Sky defended very well under pressure from Alberto Contador over the final weekend, particularly on Sunday when Thomas closed a dangerous-looking gap late on. Although there were noises coming out of Contador's Tinkoff camp that the motorbikes in the race had been a bit too close and perhaps, interfered a little bit with the chase. Lotto Soudal's Tim Wellens won that final stage on the Promenade des Anglais in Nice. And the overall winner, Thomas, was joined on the podium by Contador and Richie Port. We'll talk about Tirreno as well because a stage was cancelled there because of snow. Steve Cummings won a very memorable victory with a late attack. The race, as we speak, is ongoing and we will discuss it in more detail next week, I'm sure. Meanwhile, Dutch woman Chantal Black won the Ron van Dronth, the latest round of the Women's World Tour.
It wasn't Lotto Soudal, was it, who were competing at Paris-Nice?
Oh, no, it wasn't. It was Lotto Fixit.
On the subject of the Ron van Dronth, did you know that one of our male colleagues, T. Sonneveld, who writes for Algemeen Dagblad, rode that as an experiment, as a kind of battle of the sexes experiment, finished 54th, I think. I was thinking we'll maybe get him on in a future podcast to talk about his experience.
Excellent, excellent story.
So it sounds like a fairly convincing winner in that battle of the sexes then, but a good effort nonetheless. Well done. Paris-Nice, let's start off with Paris-Nice. I mean, That was interesting comments from Sean Yates complaining about the motos. I saw some of the motorbikes, as they're also known, fairly involved, not deliberately, in the racing when Contador attacked on one of his many attacks. I mean, so I didn't see any evidence of the motorbikes getting involved with the chase behind, but you know, I could be wrong. But it was a terrific day's racing, wasn't it? And thanks to Alberto Contador and his team who rode a blinder.
There was also some interference from Tony Gallopin, wasn't there?
Well, that was interesting, wasn't it?
You had Tony Gallopin.
Tim Wellens at the front, yeah, driving it a little bit with Contador and Richie Port. And then you had Tony Gallopin behind, also chasing with Geraint Thomas and Sergio Henao.
Yeah, Tony Gallopin, who could have been pulling for various reasons. You know, there was the stage victory. Maybe he had more confidence in himself than he did in his teammate Wellens. There was the honour of being the first Frenchman, I think, in general classification. He's also gets on pretty well with Geraint Thomas. They apparently exchange text messages about rugby. But also in these situations, you never know. There could be deals stretching about months and years between teams. You know, it may be that Lotto owe Sky a favour because of something that's happened in another race. So I think to throw our arms up in outrage at a rider from what seems to be a rival team helping Geraint Thomas and Team Sky is a little bit over the top.
Did Gallopin not also win the Bunch Gallop in Nice? So he was fourth on the stage. So, you know, had it all come back together, as it very nearly did, he would have perhaps won the stage, which would have justified his actions. But tremendous day's racing.
No, it was, Rich. Extraordinary day of racing. It's a really fantastic stage. Well, it's a fantastic course that they have sort of settled on now in Paris-Nice with that multiple ascents of the Col d'Aise. You know, very, very similar to the 2007 race, wasn't it, where Davide Rebellin lost the jersey on to Alberto Contador just over the top of the Col d'Aise. In the same way that Contador dropped Thomas, and Thomas really seemed to be cracking, having looked a lot stronger than Contador on the Col de la Madone on Saturday. He was really, well, he showed his limitations. I mean, I know it's early in the year, but he did show his limitations as Thomas as a climber. I think people who were predicting a power struggle with Chris Froome come the Tour de France when Thomas won on Saturday were maybe getting ahead of themselves slightly. However, you know, he's underlined yet again what a very strong and versatile rider he is. And he's certainly going to be a valid deputy to Chris Froome come the Tour de France. But it's really a breakthrough in Thomas's career, isn't it? I mean, he's come close to this kind of win in the past. Again, it's tinged with regret, I would suggest, in the sense that I think this is all coming slightly too late in his career. I really think that he should have been in this position and the leader in races like Paris-Nice 2 or 3 years ago.
Yeah, it's interesting as well. We can't know what impact the removal of the Montbrui stage had on the way the race played out. Obviously, Thomas was incredibly impressive on La Madone Dutel, looked really strong, had Contador, you know, off his wheel at the finale. But Contador's aggression over the final couple of stages was all down to the fact that one mounting opportunity was taken away from him. So Thomas did ride extremely well, certainly deserved the victory, but you know, that the removal of that stage undoubtedly sort of changed how the race would have panned out, I suggest.
You've seen it so many times now from Contador in these quite brief mountain stages where he really has attacked them like a sprint effort. And just, you know, I'm thinking of the 2011 Tour de France stage to Alpe d'Huez when he was out the overall classification, but he really took that stage by the scruff of the neck. And we've seen it again, we saw it again also from him in the Alpe d'Huez stage in the 2013 Tour when they climbed Alpe d'Huez twice. You know, these short 140, 150 kilometer stages. And it was a great performance by his team as well, putting two men up the road early doors. I think it was Sean Kelly made the point in the Eurosport commentary that was Sky's big mistake. You know, had the race slipped away from Thomas, they would have looked back and said, well, the mistake we made was, you know, two Tinkoff riders. It's such a well-known tactic, well, you know, often deployed tactic these days. Were we surprised? Because Team Sky looked very strong on Saturday and controlled the race pretty effectively. Were we surprised on the final day that Thomas was in the end left with just one teammate, Sergio Henao?
I think the big surprise was how good some of the riders were on the mountain stage a couple of days earlier. You know, Ben Swift was there very, very late in the line, working extremely hard. Admittedly, the pace wasn't high enough, because that was when Ben Swift was on the front. That was when all the aggression started. But they did look impressive. But you've got to remember, you know, it is March, and these aren't like the high Alps or the high Pyrenees that we get in the Tour de France. They're sort of moyenne montagne,
which underlines really the point that Daniel was making about, you know, while acknowledging this as a landmark result in Geraint Thomas's career, we do have to acknowledge that the climbs were not, you know, major Alpine or Pyrenean climbs. Col d'Aise is not, you know, the Col de Galibier. And, you know, Thomas has, you know, rode extremely well, but how confident are we that he has the climbability, acknowledging that it's March, to become a real contender in the Grand Tours?
Yeah, and without the Montbrie, the stage that was cancelled, there wasn't an awful lot of climbing in the week as a whole. So the kind of accumulated fatigue wasn't nearly what it is even after sort of 2 weeks of the Tour de France or 10 days of the Tour de France. And, you know, we saw last year, I think, again, after the Pyrenees in the Tour de France, people maybe got ahead of themselves as far as Thomas was concerned, thinking, right, he can really challenge now. He's going to end up second, third, fourth if Froome wins. And sure enough, he did suffer in the final week. And I think there is some way to go for him. And, you know, is he going to run out of time in his career? He's 30 this year, probably got realistically two or three more opportunities in theory. But of course, Chris Froome is going to be the leader for the foreseeable future. And, you know, we've talked about this before, how Team Sky, there's a real bottleneck as far as leaders in the Grand Tours are concerned. They've signed Mikel Landa. And again, you know, you look at their recruitment strategy, and I was thinking at the weekend of Pete Kenyuk, who we spoke a lot about last year, and we speculated or we thought that he might move to BMC. And he was very strong again at Tirreno Adriatico, but again, having to sacrifice himself for Kwiatkowski. And that is a signing again that you look at the Kwiatkowski signing, and it's a real luxury. It's almost a vanity signing that Sky have made. Did they really need someone? Was there a void that they really needed to fill? Or was that the point at which, you know, Pete Kenyuk could have been promoted and given his head, given his opportunity? And I think it's very much the same with Thomas, and it was very much the same 2 or 3 years ago when he was being linked to Garmin. And it's very difficult to leave Team Sky because you get great support, you get very well paid, and for a lot of the British guys in particular, it is the environment that they have always known and always thrived in. So I can fully understand why they stay, but I think it can be a bit frustrating from the outside looking at the limited opportunities that they do get.
But let's not fall into the trap of taking a Paris-Nice victory for Geraint Thomas and trying to extrapolate what that means for the Tour de France. In terms of Geraint Thomas's career, that's a big step forward. You know, previous biggest stage race wins, the Bayern-Rundfahrt for Geraint Thomas. Paris-Nice is a couple of two or three levels above that. And, you know, 2 years ago he was very close and fell off on the final day, or the penultimate day, I think. Last year he was very good, but Richie Port, his teammate, took the victory. You know, this was not a victory that was handed to him on a plate, or just, you know, it didn't fall in his lap. He beat Alberto Contador and Richie Port and finished on the top step of the podium, and it's the biggest road race win of his career.
And let's not forget also that he has had the opportunity to lead the team in the past at races such as Tour of Flanders and Paris-Roubaix, and he has invariably had some kind of bad luck. He's fallen off, or something has happened that he's not been able to deliver on all the support that's been invested in him. So it's a huge step forward from that point of view. I also think he's one of the most popular and most well-liked riders in the peloton. I mean, that again, that could be a reason for Galopin helping him. You know, there's a friendship there. And when I spoke to Tesh Benoit a couple of weeks ago, I asked him which rider he most admired of the current generation. He said Geraint Thomas. And I think he's admired because he's consistent throughout the year. He's selfless. He's always very visible. And you know, he gets stuck into the racing. So I think it'd be a popular victory for lots of reasons.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast, brought to you by Trainer Road, cycling's most effective training tool. Pair your power meter with over 800 workouts and 80 training plans to make you a faster cyclist. Visit trainerroad.com/TCP to try Trainer Road risk-free for 30 days.
Okay, you heard there our long Trainer Road jingle. We're in the final countdown, aren't we? We've got a little special coming out in the next week or so, haven't we, Lionel? A little free podcast just explaining a bit of our Trainer Road work. Thanks again to Trainer Road for their sponsorship. And if you're interested in Trainer Road, just go to trainerroad.com. You can follow our progress at trainerroad.com/TCP, but have a look and see if it takes your fancy if you want to get fit for the summer. It's worked for us, hasn't it, Lionel?
Well, look at your bikini body, Lionel.
Wow. Yeah, I think it has worked, but proof of the pudding is going to be in the...
Not a very good analogy, that one.
Not a very good analogy, that one, no. But the race at Manchester Velodrome between the two of us, Rich and Rob Hatch, is looming large now. Yeah. I think we're into the final two and a bit weeks of training.
I'm going to start my taper very soon. Mm. Chris Hoy's giving me a bit of... he's mentoring me a little bit in my final preparation. I asked him when I should start my taper, hoping he would say about now. He said maybe 2 or 3 minutes before the race, so that's not great. But one thing about the Trainer Road, following the Trainer Road programme, is that you get to avoid extreme weather.
Ah, excellent, excellent.
And extreme weather is something that we're going to be talking about now, isn't it? Because extreme weather has been on everybody's tongues.
Well, there have been two stages cancelled in the last couple of days of major races, World Tour races, Paris-Nice and Tirreno Adriatico. And it did actually occur to me that we have seen instances in the past of cricket matches called off and everyone going indoors and the match is being decided by a bowl out. So the equivalent of that would be a Trainer Road session in a big conference room in probably an Ibis hotel on the outskirts.
That's
of...
a fantastic
this
idea.
This is the future, I think.
Yeah.
This is where, it's like, I mean, how easy is that to televise?
A mass spinning class.
Yeah.
But competitive.
That'd be brilliant, yeah. Mm.
And all the riders would line up like a sort of Formula One grid. You'd have the best performers from the previous day at the front, and then...
Who'd be the spinning instructor with the Madonna-style microphone barking orders?
Prudy,
and what would the soundtrack
be? Prudhomme. Tour de France. And the soundtrack, of course, would be the Prudy Ibiza mix that we recorded last year.
Of course.
I recently remembered and played, actually, at the Home of Cycling.
Yeah, anyway. No, that would be... That's all great. But what do we make of it? I mean, as you say, the two very different events unfolded at Paris-Nice and Tirreno Adriatico. Paris-Nice, the stage was cancelled mid-stage, amid much confusion about whether the riders were going to be transported in their buses and team cars to 25 kilometres or so from the finish. And a bit like Milan-San Remo a couple of years ago, restarting. But Tirreno Adriatico, the stage was cancelled the day before. So the organisers got a lot of credit for that from a lot of the riders, but not all of the riders, it seems.
No, and there has been so much talk over the past few years, well, not even the last few years, for as long as I can remember, about how the riders, the peloton, is not a united front. And in spite of these efforts to come together, and you know, the CPA, the Professional Riders Association, particularly the American arm of that organization, has gone to great lengths to try to get a stronger voice and to get better representation for the riders. In spite of that, we saw yesterday that it's far from a homogenous unit, is it? You have riders like Vincenzo Nibali, who is frankly peeved that the only real mountain stage in Tirreno Adriatico has been cancelled, and his only real
and his
opportunity
coach,
to win the race. Yeah,
Paolo Slongo.
Yeah, and Paolo Slongo actually took the initiative of driving the route and filming it and showing that there was actually no snow on the road. And so they could have ridden, as things turned out. But yeah, they're not united, the riders. There are lots of different interests. You know, BMC were pretty happy because they think that they've got a great chance in the time trial with TJ Van Garderen. Ethics were pretty happy because they've got Stibar in the blue jersey and Bob Jungels with a great chance. So again, you know, it's kind of easy and glib to suggest, oh, you know, the riders need representation, when the riders are as
governed by selfish interests as ever. Adam Yates also not too happy because, again, it was an opportunity for him to shine. Is this not entirely normal and to be expected? And there was Matt Brammier led the assault on Nibali from some of the riders, other riders piled in, Tony Martin and others. Yeah, there seems to be a sort of quashing of dissent, that the riders are so keen to speak with one voice that any dissenting voice will be sort of named and shamed. And I found that slightly distasteful, I must say, that, you know, this idea that a rider isn't allowed an alternative viewpoint.
Yeah, I think there has to be one clear decision, but there's then allowed to be a range of opinions, you know, resulting from that decision. The decision has to be final, and really it's not really the riders who should be charged with making the decision whether to race or not. I think, as Daniel's made the point before and off air, that there needs to just be one clear decision maker, taking all of the factors into consideration. And I think both races, Paris-Nice and Tirreno-Adriatico, okay, maybe weren't the perfect decisions. Maybe they could have raced Tirreno-Adriatico. Maybe Paris-Nice could have been less confusing, but it's going to be a confusing situation. You've got 200 riders out on the road. You've got all the team cars. You've got all the other vehicles. You've got to make a decision quickly. You've got to try and get the riders to a position where they're not going to get very cold, hanging around while the decision's, you know, going back and forth. It just has to be made clearly and then deal with the consequences of that afterwards. And, I mean, I've seen on Twitter a lot of criticism because it wasn't clear and we've been deprived of a hilltop finish in Paris-Nice. But organising bike races on the road is a complex thing as it is. People suggested there should be a plan B or reroute the race round somewhere else to avoid the higher ground. But you're talking about something that is planned months in advance. You know, road closures are planned, local authorities are informed, residents of those areas are informed. You can't just suddenly divert it off onto and have, what, a rolling road closure round the hill to, what, a different finish line when everything's been set up. And I think the Tirreno-Adriatico cancellation was probably more to do with the fact that they couldn't get all of the race furniture and apparatus and banners and all the rest of it out while it was, you know, there was snow on the ground. And so they took the precautionary decision, probably the right decision, to cancel the stage rather than set off and have another confusing day of racing.
I think that the problem is that we are moving, or there is a clamour for something that resembles a democracy, certainly a democracy involving riders and organisers and perhaps even, you know, broadcasters, etc. However, there is no adequate democratic framework at the moment. We've got this thing called the Extreme Weather Protocol, which is incredibly vague. I mean, it talks about snow. It doesn't give, you know, any amount of snow. It talks about temperatures. It doesn't give specific temperatures. It basically says if it's going to be very uncomfortable to ride, then a meeting can be held and a decision can be taken. And it's far too vague. But what isn't vague now is the precedent that's been set. And the precedent was actually set in the middle of last week at Paris-Nice. And that precedent was followed at Tirreno-Adriatico, because I'm not sure if the decision at Tirreno-Adriatico would have been taken had Paris-Nice, the stage at Paris-Nice, not been cancelled first. I mean, the other thing I would say is that if we want to move towards a sport where riders don't have to encounter conditions like extreme heat, snow, and, you know, very, very dangerous conditions, that is fine. But without expressing any personal moral judgment or about whether this is right or wrong, we have to be conscious of what we stand to lose if we do that. And we have to be conscious of the fact that, you know, these stages in blizzard conditions and extreme heat and awful conditions that are very, very uncomfortable to ride in, they are part of the heritage of the sport, part of the legacy of the sport, and part of what has drawn a lot of us to the sport. And the sport, you know, you go back and read things that Henri Desgrange, the founder of the Tour de France, wrote in L'Equipe, you know, back in the early 20th century, you know, about sending cyclists over some of these mountain passes, uncharted territory. And he was absolutely in awe, and he almost pitied them, and he almost regretted designing routes that forced them to encounter that kind of terrain, this kind of weather. But cycling back then, it was a test of survival. It was something that the mere mortals,
epic.
Yeah, mere mortals could not conceive of. And there was a spirit of adventure, and it really is changing. You know, do we want to take it away from that, and do we want to move it closer to, you know, other forms of racing, i.e. motorsport, where conditions are very controlled and the road surfaces are perfect and, you know, the weather's perfect.
And they have motors.
Yeah.
And, well, it's funny you should say all this. I think we've just heard Daniel, that is the sound of Daniel coming off Matt Brammier's Christmas list, but Christmas card list. But it's funny you should say all that, Daniel, because I put this very point last week to David Miller, who was involved in drawing up the Extreme Weather Protocol. And I asked him if, you know, something could be lost because so many of the great feats, the great exploits in cycling history have been in these awful conditions. So I asked David about that, and he answered that and then made another quite interesting point that we can perhaps come back and discuss.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Freeb.
The stage in Paris-Nice was cancelled recently because it was bad weather. And that was quite extreme weather. But the point more generally that some people are making is bad weather is part of cycling. You know, some of the great feats of old, whether it be Eno at Liège, Bastogne Liège, Andy Hampson at the Giro in 1988, those wouldn't have happened with extreme weather protocols. So are you concerned that it could go too far, that it's a slippery slope?
Not really. I mean, I agree. I mean, I've always been a fan of bad weather and race. When I was at my best, I loved bad weather and races, and I like watching it. If I turn on the TV and see bad weather, I'm like, yes, this is going to be an amazing bike race. But at the same time, I've been in bike races where it's really bad and it's not pleasant. And the sport's changed. It's not the same as it was in 1978 when Eno did Liège, or if that was it, 1988, the Gavia. And to be honest, the Gavia probably could still happen because it was raining to the top, just started snowing at the top. The peloton was in pieces. There's no way that it could have been kind of stopped by that point. So, you know, there are certain races where it could still happen. But I think it's more indicative of the peloton's desire to have some respect and some control and some unification. Because I think it was getting to the point where the peloton felt it had just lost. There's no patron. Because in the past, it's been a patron that kind of controlled. Then they'll go and talk to the race organizer. That no longer existed. And also because the sport is in such, to be brutally frank, in complete disarray on all levels, from teams to governing bodies to the race organizers. So I think this empowered the peloton slightly to think that they could kind of control. Now we'll see how far that goes, but I think it's a good step for just bike racing as a whole to feel that they're not just being treated like circus animals, because there has been times where it's been like that. Because it's not just that, it's also the fact that the Giro in particular was making very dangerous courses and finishes, and there are more and more accidents and crashes, and there are more and more crashes. It was just I think it was necessary, but we'll see how it develops.
So David Miller suggesting there that the extreme weather, the rider's safety, is obviously hugely important, but it's also a sort of battleground. It's the riders asserting themselves against the race organisers, the other power brokers within the sport, that for a long time the riders feel they've not been respected or recognised as a group, and that this is a battleground for them, a place where they can assert themselves and just win back a little bit of respect. It's part of a much broader picture, isn't it, in terms of how the sport is moving forward, with Velon, with the teams joining together, a Velon to give the riders more of a stake in negotiations over TV rights and all the rest of it. It's just about the riders asserting themselves, basically.
Yeah, and I think the other factor to bear in mind is that the professionalisation, increasing professionalisation of the sport, is such that there is a pressure from the teams to the riders to all, you know, do the job, all get through the stages. We do have to kind of bear in mind that in Paris-Nice or Tirreno-Adriatico or any other race, it's not compulsory to finish. You know, riders could stop if the weather conditions are terrible.
There is an irony as well about the clothing has never been better. I mean, all of us who ride in the winter are commenting recently about riding in freezing cold conditions. Mm-hmm. This wasn't a trainer road session, obviously, but you know, with the materials and, you know, of the clothing, you wonder how the clothing manufacturers feel about not having their products tested in these terrible conditions.
Yeah, and I mean, the great editions of the great races are, you know, some of them are great because the riders rode through terrible conditions. The 1980 Liège-Bastogne-Liège, Bernard Hinault won, where, you know, people's hands were freezing and riders were, you know, urinating on their legs to try and keep themselves warm.
Beautiful.
Lovely image, that. But fewer than 30 riders finished. You know, 200 odd started, fewer than 30 finished. And that's fine. If you have a stage of Paris-Nice, and I mean, maybe there's some kind of flexibility that could be shown, tweaking of the rules. Perhaps you could have a situation where if you want to qualify for the overall classification, you've got to complete the course. But if you don't want to finish a particularly snowy day, they could invoke a kind of, you know, right, extreme
sounds
weather.
Like the Mallorca challenge to
a
me.
Bit like that. Yeah, if you want to climb off today at the feed zone and not do the rest of the stage, you will be permitted to start tomorrow, but you won't count for any of the classifications. And then we can see, you know,
sounds like a slippery slope.
We can get back to, you mentioned Henri de Grange, you know, his dream Tour de France would be one, a challenge so tough that only one person would be capable of finishing.
He also didn't want riders to use gears or to change clothing. He wanted them to finish in the clothing they started. Do we want to go back to that? Well, I think we're all going to be off Matt Bramier's Christmas list at this rate.
But we're balancing two different things here, aren't we? That the sport is trying to, you know, convey an image of being the toughest, some of the most difficult challenges.
It's a balance.
And I think you're right, Daniel. We will lose something if...
And, you know, the disunity, I think, as always, as we've said, it's always existed. And this weekend reflected the fact that it still exists, and it's, the battleground is different now. It's played out on Twitter and social media, riders sort of accusing each other of things and disagreeing about things. You know, sometimes you're tempted to imagine that it would be better if we could go back to the time of Bernardino or even Mario Cipollini, who would literally just ride in front of the bunch and decide what everyone was going to do. I mean, but even that doesn't work. I mean, there's a good example here from 1988, not very well known, a couple of days, or I think it might have been the day after the Gavia, to the famous
in the
stage of the 1988 Giro d'Italia, which went over the Gavia, famous for Andy Hampston's incredible ride. And the winner that day was Eric Breukink, wasn't it?
Correct.
Anyway, the next day, or 2 days later, the peloton was supposed to go into Austria over the Passo del Rombo. And because of what happened on the Gavia, there was a lot of speculation about whether weather was going to be even worse, a lot of talk about blizzards, etc. And the race organizer, the race chief, Vincenzo Torriani, agreed that if there was any snow whatsoever, the riders would be able to get off their bikes. And what happened was they started riding at the Passo del Rombo, and sleet or snow or some kind of precipitation of some description started falling, and a huge debate ensued in the peloton about whether it was snow, whether it was sleet, or whether it was rain. And the way that the French rider Jean-François Bernard tried to solve this dispute was to ride in front of the peloton, park himself on the road, and block his fellow riders from going past. And he insisted that it was snow and they all had to stop. And of course, they just rode straight past, or half the peloton just rode straight past.
A perfect example of why Jean-François Bernard was not actually the heir to Bernardino, who he replaced as team leader at La Vie Claire, what became Toshiba. That's it wouldn't have happened to Eno, would it? I mean, David Miller made that point that one of the reasons for the need for this type of protocol and for just the riders trying to come together as one body is the absence of a patron. I know that Fabien Cancellara
fancies
himself.
Yeah, well, let's just have a proper democratic framework. Let's have a vote. You know, if the riders want a vote and they want it to be completely democratic, then all 200 have to...
In a democracy, you're also permitted to voice an alternative opinion, as Nibali has done and has been ridiculed and picked upon for doing so.
There's a real possibility here, isn't there? You could have little handlebar-mounted voting.
Well, they could go to the urn just as they could take their bike to get scanned for motors, and at the same time, while they're waiting for that to happen, they could drop a little
ballot.
Yeah,
but while they were going along, the weather's getting worse. Right at the next kilometre, we're going to all vote. There'll be a voting zone. They'll go through. They'll press yes, we carry on, or no, we're stopping.
Or one hand up for yes, two hands up for no. Richie Port might have problems with that. He famously can't ride no-handed, so.
Anyway, we're reshaping the future of cycling here.
Eurosport, the home of cycling.
Milan-San Remo is the first one-day race on the UCI World Tour calendar, and at 291 kilometres, the longest. First held in 1907, supported by the Italian sports paper La Gazzetta dello Sport, Milan-San Remo has a couple of nicknames. La Primavera, because it's the event of the spring, and La Classicissima, which loosely translates as the Great Classic. The course is predominantly flat, with a few famous hills, including the Turchino at around the halfway mark, the Capi, which are three small hills that come in quick succession, kicking off the beginning of the end of the race, and the most famous, the Cipressa and the Poggio, in the last 25 kilometres. The thing that makes it a great race is the suspense that grows towards the end. Will a breakaway succeed, or will it come down to a sprint? As the riders say, Milan-San Remo is easy to finish but difficult to win. Here are a few things you may not know about the race. In 1960, the Poggio was added, partly because the organisers thought it might break a six-year run of foreign winners. It didn't work. In fact, it was another 10 years before Michele Dancelli ended the Italian drought. The most wins by a single rider is 7 by Eddie Merckx between 1966 and 1976. In 1979, Roger de Vlaeminck had signed for a new team sponsored by Gisc Gelati, an Italian ice cream maker. The boss of the company arrived at the start in Milan in a brand new Ferrari and promised de Vlaeminck he could have it if he successfully defended his title. De Vlaeminck won the race and drove his prize all the way home to Belgium. In 1982, the Cipressa was introduced to shake things up, and it certainly did that. Marc Gomez, a Frenchman who'd only been a professional a few weeks, got in the early break and stayed away to the finish to win. In 1992, Ireland's Sean Kelly won with his famous pursuit of Moreno Argentin on the Poggio. Check it out on YouTube if you haven't seen it. Almost as famous as his daredevil descending was a spectacularly ugly helmet he was wearing. It looked like an upturned mixing bowl. Anyway, what you may not know is that Kelly was sponsored by the helmet manufacturer and was due a big bonus if he won a monument wearing it. Towards the end of the race and shortly before things began to kick off, Kelly dropped back to the team car to collect the helmet, and after the race he collected his bonus. In 2004, Eric Zabel thought he'd won for the fifth time but celebrated too soon, lifting his arms off the handlebars in salute of his victory, only for Spain's Oscar Freire to pip him on the line. Perhaps the closest ever finish, though, was in 2009, when Mark Cavendish, who was making his debut in the race, outsprinted Heinrich Hausler by millimetres. In 2013, bad weather caused the race to be shortened and they cut around 40 kilometres from the route, and the riders were transported further down the road in their team buses. After they resumed, Gerald Cialek won the race. In recent years, the route has been tweaked, and in 2015, the finish line returned to the famous Via Roma, which was first used in 1949. Anyway, how do you go about winning Milan San Remo? We thought we'd ask 2014 champion Alexander Kristoff.
Yeah, I was not really like a favorite going in there, more like an outsider. Somebody would mention that maybe could make a result, and yeah, I did the same preparation like I did now with Paris-Nice and also Qatar, Oman, and had Nieuwsblad Kuhn. I remember the years before, I was maybe the year before I was 9 or something, and I won the sprint from the group, so I knew the race suits me quite well, but still the last climb was just too tough. But I was the week before feeling good shape during training and also did some intervals with really good numbers and came in there quite confident of my shape, but still not expecting to win. I think that was maybe the most important win in my career because it was the first monument and the first big win, you know. And last year, I remember everything was for me, but I think also the year before, it was for me if I was still there after Cipressa and also getting into Cipressa, I was protected of. For sure, and then they will look if I'm still there after Cipressa, and if I'm there, for sure they go for me. But now I know I can handle it, so for sure this year we will all go for me again. I see my numbers. If I do a sprint after 6-7 hours, it's not really much slower than if I do it when I'm fresh. Slightly worse, but not a big difference.
Can you tell me what those numbers are?
No.
Or is that a secret?
That's a secret. So, well, it really depends. You can suddenly, if you're lucky, you can hit almost 2,000 watts in a sprint, but and sometimes I only did to 1,500. Maybe then it depends a little bit on the legs and how fresh I am also. And also, I think a little bit with the gearing. If I hit the gear and then smash down, then the peak power gets really high.
So Milan San Remo, it's a race of patience. You have to wait and wait. There's so much riding to do before even you get to the early climbs. What's the first 3 or 4 hours in the peloton like? Are you just trying to stay out of the wind completely, try to have a very stress-free ride?
Yeah, there's a lot of transport, especially before Turchino, also for sure after. But yeah, just ride, actually try not to use too much energy, try to stay as easy as possible, but sometimes it's a little bit slight wind or something, but yeah, don't really think too much about it and just try to get the hours going, you know, and eat and take care of food and drinks, and then getting into these capos and everything is more, then you get more to a race rhythm. And also I feel San Remo is always really fast, like you on the coast there, and it's always rolling really well.
So for you, where does the race really begin?
Oh, it begins maybe with like 70. When we enter this capos, then it starts to get stressful, really. And then for sure the fight before Cipressa is important. And yeah, there the race is really on. So, like the last 20K maybe before Cipressa is really like almost like if it's going into a sprint.
So where were you going over the top of the Cipressa? Can you remember?
Last year, I think I was the last guy in the back. I was really struggling last year. The year before, I was a little bit feeling better there, but I'm not the first, that's for sure.
And then comes the Poggio, which is really the last chance that the attackers have to try and get rid of you guys. What were you thinking when you were going over the Poggio? You're just hoping that nobody manages to break away and stay away.
Yeah, no, I just had to go as fast as I can, and usually it's not enough to be in the among the best or the first guys. So when I won it, I was actually almost dropped a little bit and came back in the downhill and then straight to the front. So what is nice with this race also, because it's like all different riders can win it actually, because if somebody manages to bridge away or get away, then it's not a sprinter winning, and if it comes back together, it's a sprinter winning. So it's very open and a lot of guys have an opportunity, so it makes it also a very great race, I think.
It's a very technical descent though, isn't it? You've got to be careful, particularly in the corners. There's some fast ones and some slow ones.
Yeah, there is some dangerous corners there, and I don't really remember every year, but it's always one corner, right corner is quite tight.
So talk about the last kilometer then. You're in the position you want to be in, but you don't really know how good your legs are going to be until you start to sprint. So what are you thinking as everything is moving around you? Because when I watch the finish, you're just staying on Paolini's wheel, just patient. People are coming left and right, but you're not really moving.
I want to move the last 200 meters, so for sure I need a position to be able to win. I cannot be in the last position. So when I won it, I was quite in the front all the time, and I was on Luca, and then I was on Philippe Gilbert, and then they started. I was a little bit boxed actually around 200 meters, but then it opened up for me and I could do my sprint. So for me, it's just I must have the position, and I must find a way it's open so I can sprint, and hopefully I just have the better legs than others.
It's quite a beautiful part of the Italian coast. Does that even register with you at all, looking at the sea and the countryside, or is that just you're just concentrating on the road?
I'm most concentrating on the road. I watched it on television a few years ago, and yeah, it's a very beautiful race, but when I was in it, actually almost every year I did it was really weather, so I didn't really enjoy it.
Okay, we heard there from Lionel Burney with the return of the Lionel lecture, and it's slightly different. I think now you're going to be sort of previewing a race that's coming up on Eurosport. Thank you very much to Eurosport for their continued sponsorship of the podcast. Milan Sanremo is a big one, of course, on the 19th of March, but coming up next week, 21st to 27th of March, is the Tour of Catalonia, next big World Tour stage race, and 25th is E3 Harelbeke, the Friday. That's another good one, back in Belgium on the cobbles again. So lots coming up on Eurosport, home of cycling. But we spoke about Milan Sanremo, and Lionel, not one. Funny that you're doing this really, because you're not one for speculation, are you? We heard from Alexander Kristoff there as well.
Well, we did, yeah, but we weren't speculating. We're about to start speculating now.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah, no, fair enough. Yeah, I get you. I get the subtle distinction there. Well, in the absence of given your reluctance to speculate, Lionel, Daniel, who do you think is going to shine at Milan Sanremo?
Well, I'm going to make a prediction straight away. For years, and we've certainly discussed this on the podcast before, I think for years the winner of Milan Sanremo came from Tirreno Adriatico, and I think that run was broken by Matt Goss in 2011. However, that pattern has changed slightly in the past 3 or 4 years. That's probably got something to do with the routes on Tirreno and Paris-Nice respectively. I've spoken to a couple of riders who are riding Tirreno in the last few days, and they have told me that the route this year in Tirreno, particularly with the cancellation of the big mountain stage, has been perfect preparation for Milan Sanremo for the first time in a long time. Long stages with small climbs, but hard climbs towards the end of stages. And, we saw years when, for instance, Oscar Freire won Tirreno Adriatico, and it didn't used to be a very mountainous race, and those were the years when ultimately it proved to be the best preparation for Milan Sanremo. So I think a rider who is doing Tirreno will win Milan Sanremo.
Well, who? Gaviria? Well, people talking about Fernando Gaviria, who won a stage the other day straight from the World Track Cycling Championship. It was an incredible sprint, that. Mark Cavendish was leading out for a while, I think, for Edvald Boasenhagen, but Gaviria, gee, wow, he was sprinting for about 300 metres.
Yeah, and he has climbed extremely well throughout the week in Tirreno Adriatico. Davide Bramati, the direct supportee for Etix Quickstep, certainly thinks Gaviria's got a great chance. He's sort of flown under the radar just because people can't really believe that a debutant who has hardly ridden in Europe could contend for Milan Sanremo. But of course, we've seen debutants sprinters win Milan San Remo before, haven't we, Mark Cavendish?
What about Edvald Boasenhagen, though, as well? I mean, he seems to be on fire at the moment, and it's always, we spoke to Mark Cavendish about it a couple of weeks ago. He was very reluctant to, I thought, suspiciously reluctant to talk about Boasenhagen and Milan San Remo, which suggested to me that he thinks he's got a very good chance. It was a race that Team Sky always thought that Boasenhagen could and should win.
But never really came close, did it?
Never came close,
never,
no.
Really.
But he's going
like
very
winning.
Well.
He is going extremely well. Again, has been slightly more, hasn't been quite as prominent at Tirreno Adriatico. And there's a lot of know-how in that team, Dimension Data, his new team, that will help him devise a strategy. Rolf Aldag is there, who guided Cavendish and Matt Goss to victory at Milan-San Remo. Also rode four times, I think, with Eric Zabel as part of Eric Zabel's winning telecom team at Milan-San Remo. Cavendish himself will be able to advise Boasenhagen. So, he's got every chance of putting up a good effort this time.
My prediction is that Peter Sagan will be second or third. Lionel?
I'm reluctant to predict, to be honest.
Christoph, your friend Christoph. I mean, he didn't start the final stage at Pyrenees, did he?
No, and he's not had the best of weeks.
And
there.
He's not got Luca Paolini, who's been last year, although he didn't win, he went close last year, and Paolini did a power of work for him and seemed to just shepherd him to the finish.
I think now that it's back to the original, the original modern course, the kind of pre 2008 course, is this, without Lamani and back in the Via Roma, the second year back in the Via Roma, the pendulum swings back towards the sprinters, and I wouldn't be surprised if it's quite a big group.
But Michael Matthews,
why not? I mean, he was climbing extremely well on that stage to Lamadon Dutel. Did get dropped obviously when it got very difficult, but I wouldn't have expected him to have made it that far. Really.
And I think he would have won last year had Degenkolb not shut the door on him very cleverly in the finish. He was coming off Christoph's wheel. Degenkolb came up the left and just did enough to block his path to the line. And I think perhaps Matthews is sort of knocking on the door, isn't he, of a huge win like that.
Yeah, and the best thing about Milan-San Remo is that, we really don't know. I mean, there are more riders in the frame for this than for any other monument, really.
That's what we love about it.
Yeah,
I love it.
I love
the way Milan-San Remo builds towards this crescendo.
And if the winner is going to come from Pyrenees, because Christoph rode Pyrenees, Matthews rode Pyrenees, I'm also going to throw Nasser Buhani into the mix. Sixth in his first Milan-San Remo last year. Very impressive. In Pyrenees, his train was extremely impressive in Pyrenees, and I don't think the Cipressa will cause him any problems. I don't think the Poggio will cause him any problems, and I'm sure he'd be an extremely popular winner with his peers, particularly.
are you joking, Daniel?
I might be.
He was guilty of a dodgy manoeuvre with Matthews in Pyrenees. He was disqualified for that. No worse, I thought, perhaps not as bad as Peter Sagan's elbow in Tirreno Adriatico.
I think it was pretty bad what Buhani did. No?
Yeah, I don't know. He had his head down as he tends to do. It was Abdujaparov-esque. And when you watched it, I wasn't sure. He's certainly aware that Matthews is on his inside, but he did sort of veer to the left when he put his head down. And you don't know how much, in moments like that, a rider is even sort of conscious of what he's doing. You're kind of...
No, I think Buhani has two problems. One is, he has several problems that I think cause him to make mistakes in finales of stages. One is his sprinting style. As you say, he sprints with his head down, which is never helpful. And I think he's just too anxious and too ambitious. I think we've said before, he sort of reminds us of a young Mark Cavendish. He just burns with ambition, but the thing that Cavendish always had that Buhani hasn't yet developed is an ability to channel that and stay cool and make good decisions when the pressure is on in the final 300 metres of stages. And that would be my concern at Milan-San Remo as well. I think Buhani will get into the position, but it's whether he can follow the right wheels and make the right decisions on the finishing straight.
Well, we're looking forward to Milan-San Remo. You're off to Milan-San Remo, aren't you, Daniel? You're going there for the cycling podcast.
I am.
You're going to bring us back some fantastic audio dispatches.
Wonderful material, yeah.
Great. We look forward to that next week. So we should wrap things up for this week. Thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
One name, just to finish on one name for Milan Sanremo. My outside is Navratilovas. I've already said that.
Okay, I'll say Michael Matthews.
I look forward to seeing how your predictions go.
Brilliant. Thanks very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
You've been listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Thank you to Glass Pear for the music in this episode. For more information and to download more editions of the show, visit thecyclingpodcast.com.